You're listening to the WGBH Forum Network Current Events Podcast. Each week, we'll bring you the perspectives of leading professors, economists, policymakers, authors, and community leaders on the topics affecting your daily life. It's a chance to dig deeper into today's hot-button issues: politics, economics, U.S. and world events, and more. The Forum Network is a service of WGBH. Our website contains thousands of video and audio lectures on a variety of subjects. Stop by and explore a world of ideas at wgbh.org/forum.
I'm now very pleased to introduce tonight's speakers, Jody Kantor and John Palfrey. Jody Kantor is a Washington correspondent for the New York Times and an alumna of Slate.com, having left Harvard Law School to join the then-new online magazine back in 1998. 4 years later, she became the Arts and Leisure editor of the New York Times, revamping the section and helping lead a makeover of the Culture Report. She's been covering the Obamas since early 2007, also writing about numerous political figures along the way, including Hillary Clinton, John McCain, and Mitt Romney. Tonight, Ms. Kantor will be discussing her new book on the Obamas with Professor John Palfrey. John Palfrey is a Harvard Law School alum, in addition to being a professor and vice dean for library and information resources at the law school. He is also a faculty co-chair of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society and the author of various books on our increasingly digital lives. You've probably heard at least something about tonight's book. The Chicago Sun-Times recently wrote, "Much has been made about Jody Kantor's new book, The Obamas. But above all, the breathless headlines it has inspired, the book is a fascinating study on the isolating, constantly scrutinized nature of living in the White House. Kantor's thoroughly reported avalanche of anecdotes paints a portrait of four happy and grateful Chicagoans who nonetheless pine for home and surround themselves with what little pieces of it they can hold on to." We're very pleased to bring its author to Harvard Bookstore this evening. Please join me in welcoming Jody Kantor and Professor John Palfrey.
Jody, this is such a treat to be here back in Harvard Square with you and to welcome you back to the zip code 02138. You may know part of the story, but Jody started out as a law student in 1998, as did I, and the Harvard Law School is broken into sections, roughly speaking, 110 students at a time. And Jody was, without a doubt, the smartest kid in our section by all reports. But within 2 months, she decided she didn't want to be a law student. And before exams, I think, even kicked in, she had a job at Slate and had left us as a reporter. It was a crushing blow, but also it was easy to see that you would soar to these heights very quickly after not becoming a lawyer. So congratulations on this book, and I'm glad it's worked out so well, even though you didn't get past exams in the first part of the Harvard Law School. I wanted to start out actually with one of your own questions, if that's okay. In the beginning of the book, you frame the problem that you're taking up, and you say that the most difficult question, or the more difficult question, was the reverse: the impact of their partnership, the Obamas' partnership, their debates and differences, shared ideas about themselves, and deep hesitation about politics on the presidency, the job of the first lady, and the nation. In public, they smiled and waved, but how were the Obamas really reacting to the White House, and how was it affecting the rest of us? Seems to me that you built a lot of the book around this particular hard question. I wonder if you wouldn't mind starting there.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to the Harvard Bookstore. Thank you particularly to John. It is incredibly fun and satisfying to come back to Cambridge and be with you here tonight, even though your account of my work at Harvard Law School is exactly the kind of highly exaggerated account
right.
that could get you
I
in a lot
other
of
faculty
trouble.
Members here who will back it up. So.
but it really is. It's really special to see you all here. So thank you so much. I wrote the book really because I wanted to capture something that I felt I couldn't really capture in 1,100-word stories for the paper, as much as I love writing for the New York Times. You know, when I I started covering the Obamas in 2007, and what I really felt that I was watching was the transformation of two people into president and first lady, which is not something that happens on inauguration day in a flash, but is a really slow, and I think in some ways very difficult process. And the things that I kept seeing, especially once I started doing some reporting in the White House, were how completely the presidency affects every aspect of your existence. I mean, you know, in my reporting, I learned that it affected, you know, the way people acted around Barack Obama moment to moment, his basketball game, the Obama's relationships with their family members, the way they kind of processed information in the world. And so I wanted to get at that total change. And I felt that it had a lot of consequence for us for a number of reasons. First of all, part of the reasons the Obamas were so appealing in 2008 is that they really seemed like citizens of the real world. So what happens when you put them into this extremely unusual, tense, constrained environment of the White House? The second thing is that the weird thing about the presidency is that it's so incredibly personal. You know, quirks and habits and mistakes that would not matter, frankly, in my job or yours or any of yours can matter tremendously and have consequences for the nation. And then there was this other thing I knew about the Obamas from the biographical reporting I had been doing them on them for years, which is that they are two Harvard Law School trained debaters, essentially, and that their union and their partnership had been a kind of dialectic back and forth for years and years. And they had always been dealing with two questions. How much change can you accomplish through the political system? And how livable can political life be? And I began to see that in the White House, they were confronting these questions in a more intense and consequential way than ever before. And I also think that those are important questions. Like, the questions in their marriage are not petty questions. They're not questions exclusive to them. They're questions that, you know, that are really important to the way our society and our government functions. And so it was one of those things where I saw a story there and I really wanted to see if I could find it.
So I'm sure there are lots of very particular questions people have about the Obamas' marriage, and I would like to get to some of that too. But just sort of stepping back a little bit, after you've written this book and thought about it and had to answer a lot of these questions on this book tour, it seems like a lot of what you're centering the reporting on is actually Michelle Obama and her moral and intellectual and in many respects, sort of pervasive influence on the presidency. I wonder if you would reflect on that and what you think. What do you think that influence is, and how that will play out over the next few years?
She does. She is sort of the center of the book, and you could even argue that she walks away with it a little bit. I think for two reasons.
I had to remind myself that it was called The Obamas when I came back to it.
Yeah. No, there is a lot on the president there, but there were a couple
especially
of things.
Especially basketball. That does get a lot of play.
Yeah. You know, first of all, I in a way, she's the most dramatic character in the Obama story to me, because she, just a couple of years ago, was a hospital executive in Chicago, and she never really wanted this life. And, you know, her objections to it weren't only the kind of, well, I'm a mom and I'm worried about my kids objections, as important as those are. She also had real worries about what could be accomplished in government, what could be accomplished through the legislative process. And when she gets to Washington, she is such a stranger in a strange land. She's so new in every way because she's never been the kind of typical, you know, political wife clapping politely in the first row, listening to her husband's speech. You know, there was a moment that Laura Bush's chief of staff told me about that I found really arresting. After Election Day 2008, Laura Bush showed Michelle Obama around the White House, and she took her to the sitting room in the private residence that has a little window that overlooks the Rose Garden and the Oval Office. And Laura Bush said to Michelle Obama, my mother-in-law, Barbara Bush, showed this window to Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton showed it to me, and I'm showing it to you, and one day you will show it to your successor. And she and Laura Bush talked about how she used to just stand there at the window and look out at the Oval Office and the Rose Garden and kind of look out on what was going on in her at her husband's presidency, but she stood a little bit to the side so that nobody could see her. And that struck me as such a powerful metaphor for first ladyhood, because these women are so close to power. They are the only ones who really know what the president goes through. They experience the presidency so intensely, and yet they remain a little bit hidden. You know, I guess I did want to bring Michelle Obama out of hiding a little bit, because this president is very hard to understand. I mean, I've said it a million times in my reporting. Other people have. He really is an introvert. You know, he's a complicated thinker. His thinking doesn't always track with conventional political thinking. He, even though he's the memoirist in chief, while he's been the president, he hasn't always given us a clear sense of what he's thinking and what he wants to do and how he analyzes situations in every moment. And I felt that if we could understand Michelle Obama's reactions to what was going on in the presidency and experience her as a real human being with, you know, concerns and anxieties and hopes for this presidency, then we would understand a lot more about some of the internal debates and conflicts and hopes and worries about the Obama story.
One of the things in that interplay you make a great deal of in the book, and I don't mean to give too much up, there's so many wonderful parts of this book, so even if Jody answers these questions perfectly and completely, you should still read the book. So one thing you talk a fair amount about is the areas where Michelle Obama has an interest and then areas where she plainly doesn't. And somewhat it divides, seems like, on foreign policy, domestic policy lines to some extent. And you talk some about the Let's Move initiative that she launches and the military families and so forth. But I wonder if you could expand on that in terms of what you, how that relates to the previous question in terms of where she does have an impact on the presidency and where you've seen her purposely step back.
I'm glad you asked, because this was one of the areas where, like, a very strange experience for me as an author in the last couple of weeks has been seeing coverage of my own book. And there were times when I was watching cable TV or whatever where I just wanted to hit the pause button and, like, be able to step in and say, no, it wasn't really like that. It wasn't, you know, you're not sort of, you know, you have to look at the book itself and what I actually describe. And, you know, something that I think is really important to understand about her influence is that this isn't, like, the caricatured meddling first lady. There are no stories of Michelle Obama bursting into the West Wing in the summer of 2009 saying, the public option or bust. You know, this is not a first lady who immersed herself in policy details and wanted a kind of controlling stake in what was happening in the day-to-day decision-making of the presidency. Instead, the way aides and advisors have described her is much more the keeper of the Obama flame, the person who is most connected to the reasons he ran in the first place, who sees her husband as a transformational figure and not an everyday politician. And, it, you know, in particular, I talk about her backing two initiatives that have something in common: health care reform, which eventually passed, and immigration reform, which didn't. And what those two have in common is that they were both ambitious, politically risky initiatives, right? Health care reform did cost the president a lot of political capital. Immigration reform would have, he did spend political capital on it and still couldn't really get it passed. And I think it's really important not to remove the president from the equation. This is not like a sort of Lady Macbeth situation of her running things from behind and wanting to do these things and her and the president being a kind of passive figure. But what aides talked about were the fact that she really stressed the need to kind of reach past everyday Washington politics and reach for these big things, and that she was willing to pay political costs in a way that political advisors are not always willing to.
Can we shift gears a little bit to your reporting process for this? Obviously, you had covered the Hillary Clinton campaign at one point in the last cycle. Then you covered the Obamas. You write the wonderful New York Times Magazine piece on them. You have a lot of material from that. And then you decide to shift into book mode. Could you talk a little bit about the process you went through to get at the stories that you have here and who was
sure.
helpful and not, to the extent that you're willing to share that?
No, absolutely. The White House really cooperated with this book. I had been, you know, talking to people in Obamaland for about 3 years by the time I started this. And the funny thing is that I don't know that I've ever written a story about the president or first lady that wasn't like sensitive or touchy or delicate in some way. Actually, the first story I wrote about the president is connected to Harvard. It was about him as the president of the Harvard Law Review. But the second one, I broke the news of the tensions between him and Jeremiah Wright. And so I was on the Jeremiah Wright story for a while. And, you know, I've written about race. I've written about family. I've written about the Obamas' marriage. I always wrote these kind of deeply personal stories that were pretty sensitive and had a pretty good, you know, working reportorial relationship. I think because some of those stories had been very hard to do and we had managed to sort of work through it. So I ended up interviewing about 33 current and former White House aides, also some of the Obamas' closest friends. Also, you know, there were other people, say, from back in Chicago who saw the Obamas occasionally but were very helpful in filling in, like, sort of, okay, this is the change I'm watching them go through, or here's an interesting encounter I had with them that tells us a lot. And the other thing that I think is very important to mention is that the book was fact-checked before publication by me and also by I hired a fact checker. So for all of the kind of, you know, you and cry over the book, the reporting has actually not really been disputed. Nobody's come forward to say, like, such and such didn't happen, you know, or I never said that quote or anything like that.
So let's talk about the hue and cry, since I think most people would have encountered it some way on their way to the bookstore here. I made the mistake, as I told you, of reading David Remnick's review in The New Yorker before I read this, and it's always a mistake to read someone else's reviews before you've read the text. But I wonder what your reaction has been to the reaction to the book. There's kind of a meta story here.
Yeah.
And in particular, if you can unpack some of the clearly weird politics that are playing out around the book, kind of the story associated with the story.
You know what's so funny? When I started this project, I really panicked and even went to my editors at the Times and wondered if I should not go ahead with it because, you know, I said to them, what if I don't find anything out? When you, at the paper, if you start a reporting project and it doesn't go very well, it's no big deal. It's like 3 days of wasted effort and the institution is built to, you know, you're doing something wrong if you don't have a couple of false starts, right? Whereas with a book, you're really throwing yourself into a void because you're, as a reporter, you're saying, I didn't know, for example, that Michelle Obama was having a rough time in the White House initially when I started the book project. I didn't really know any of that. So I guess what I'm working up to is that the thing that did happen is that I did uncover, in a way, much more information than I expected to. And so when the book came out, it made a lot of headlines. So, you know, every author wants to have an impact, so it's hard to complain about that. But I did find that there was a period of about a week where people were talking about the book in the abstract, and almost none of them had read the book. And curiously enough, one of them was the First Lady of the United States herself. And so Ron, my husband is back here somewhere. Ron and I were watching TV that Thursday morning with our daughter Talia. We were like in our pajamas or something, and we saw Michelle Obama on CBS talk to Gayle King. And the conversation was very hard to parse because she said she hadn't read the book, and yet she seemed to be reacting to some of the furor around the book. And, you know, that's what White House aides said later, that she wasn't sort of directly addressing it. And I was definitely surprised, by what she said about... I wasn't surprised that she said in general that she had been frustrated about being represented as an angry black woman, because in my reporting I had always known that she had faced those stereotypes, especially during the 2008 campaign, and that, the Obamas have experienced both the pressures and possibilities of being the first African American president and first lady very intensely. But I guess the thing that I was surprised by was, any notion that I depicted her that way in this book. As most reviewers have said, she's depicted as a strong presence, absolutely an impassioned person and somebody who really cared about the presidency going well. But there's no place in the book where she's depicted as, like, quote unquote, manipulative or, irrational or anything like that. And I one of the things I really tried to do was discuss the experience of first ladies in general. And so I think there is a group of women who in this book she has a lot of in common with, but it's not, it's not quote unquote angry black women, it's first ladies. There's a story in the book about what happened when Rahm Emanuel made a deal for Michelle Obama to appear at a Florida event in exchange for a vote on an energy bill that was moving through the House. A very important piece of legislation, as most of you know. It ended up being this sort of half-born baby because it passed the House and not the Senate. And there was this congressman named Alan Boyd in Florida, a white congressman, who was going to vote no on the legislation. But he said he would vote yes if Michelle Obama came down to Florida and did an event with him. What sort of remained in the background is that Boyd had a potential black challenger in Florida. So for the first lady to come down and do an event with him would be like a very important piece of political signaling. So Emanuel makes the deal and says yes without consulting Michelle Obama. And when she finds out, she's very frustrated. So when I told that story in the book, I also took care to research and tell another very similar story. And lo and behold, something very similar had happened between Hillary Clinton and Rahm Emanuel when she was first lady. He had promised her presence at something without asking her. She had essentially the same reaction, which is like, hello, you're treating me like chopped liver, like I'm not a pawn to be moved around politically without my consultation.
It's easier to do as mayor, I think.
Yeah. They completely had it out, actually. They had much more of a classic sort of, direct confrontation about it than Emanuel and Michelle Obama did. But part of what I was trying to say with stories like that is that there is so much that I found that she experienced that really did hold to the pattern, of her predecessors. And to me, that context was so important in establishing her not as a figure who is high maintenance, which is one of the pejoratives sometimes applied to political wives, but instead as somebody who was reacting as a lot of her predecessors did.
So I have a couple more questions, then I want to open it up. So if you're thinking of questions, get them ready. Speaking of relationships, one of the relationships you make a lot of and then gets picked up a fair amount in the coverage of your book is the Jarrett Gibbs relationship. And I was curious why, of the many that were plausible to play out among White House aides, obviously they're both very important, why did you choose that and how did that play really into the Obama story as well as the kind of broader picture of the narrative you're trying to
I mean, Valerie Jarrett and Robert Gibbs represent two of the kind of opposite pressures in Obama world. On the one hand, they're both incredibly invested in the president's success, and I think both, in their way, kind of idealists, who want to see him fulfill the promise of his candidacy. But Gibbs, who's now has a slightly more distant relationship, he's now a kind of outside paid consultant to the campaign. Gibbs represents the kind of rules of the political world, right? I mean, he was the guy during the campaign, first during the Senate campaign, then during the presidential campaign, then in the White House, who had to defend everything to the outside world, right? And so he was constantly aware of the constraints, the things that you couldn't do, the need to be cautious, the limitations. And for the Obamas, I think those things were very hard to accept because there is this weird way in which they weren't kind of real politicos, right? I mean, not to not to overburnish their innocence, but they, you know, they were not creatures of green rooms. They were not used to living a public life in which everything was scrutinized. And Gibbs a little bit played like the enforcer of like, no, you can't do that. That's going to look really bad in public. Jarrett is this totally different person and personality. She is a really close friend and mentor of the Obamas, who's also taken on substantive responsibilities first in the campaign and then in the White House. And she has this connection to the Obamas that almost nobody there has. I mean, she even goes on vacation with them. She's equally close to the president and first lady. And that closeness, I saw in my reporting, has really protected and buoyed the Obamas as they've been through these huge transitions. But it's sometimes caused friction as well, because there is a sense in which she's a little bit separate, you know, from the other advisors and has this private relationship with them. So probably, like, if you're looking for your classic, you know, Washington clash, probably the most spectacular scene in the book is this meeting in which they have a very difficult confrontation. Jarrett actually remains very calm, but Gibbs really loses it, and he ends up using the F word against the First Lady in a meeting. Not the President and First Lady weren't in the meeting. It was a staff meeting, but it was a shocking thing. And then when I talked to him about it, he turned around and said he actually wasn't upset at the First Lady. He was upset with Jarrett. And he used very harsh language, you know, on the record in the book. He said things that are unusual. He said she's not trustworthy. She doesn't kind of play fairly. She promotes herself at the expense of other advisors. And to me, part of the lesson of that incident is that, you know, the close-knit group of advisors who have surrounded the president have not always been as unified as they look from the outside. You know, the thing that was always said in Washington is, oh, this president is so insular because he's got this tiny cadre of people around him, you know, and they sort of talk to each other and don't talk to the outside world enough. But actually, that group of people is quite diverse, and the strains within that group have grown very intense at times.
It's very interesting. It's one of the wonderful things about the book is how you play those out. My last question for you, though, is it's an un-question, actually. You've been on the book tour now and talking to the John Stewarts and others, but also more broadly in lots of bookstores like this. And I know that in my own experience, when I do the same talk over and over again, I get a bunch of questions in my mind, and then I call it like, that's question 91, and that's question 97, and 97A and B. But I wonder if you might think through whether or not there's a question that you wished that you were to be asked and that you never actually get asked, and that maybe you would ask it of yourself and answer it.
Oh, that's a great question.
I didn't think I could stump Jody Cantor.
Yeah.
You can think about it if you want, and I can.
Yeah, we might have to
come back.
We'll
revisit.
I want to give you a real answer, not a quickie. So let's come back to it.
But you can see that we didn't actually plan all the questions in advance. So I want to actually do a cold call on a fellow Harvard Law School professor who usually spends his time cold calling others. But earlier today I was talking to my friend Jonathan Zittrin about this event, and he had a wonderful question. So I wonder if you would ask your hard question of Jody as the first one. Was how would you react to the notion of a movie deal? You know, Hachette gets approached by Hollywood to make this into a lightly fictionalized, as Joe Klein and Anonymous, or in the case of the Facebook movie.
I guess what's important to me as a journalist is that when things are fictionalized, they're labeled as such. First of all, there's no, like, that's not sort of a question I've been dealing with, so it's a pretty theoretical question at this point. I think that, if you see The Queen, which is a really, really great movie about Queen Elizabeth, and that is a fictional treatment, and in a way that writer uses fiction to go where no journalist could ever go, because it takes place so inside the palace, and the queen is such a locked away figure. And I really loved that movie and thought it was fabulous. And I also thought that it was a very honest movie in terms of it never claimed to be, you know, a movie about sort of what actually happened. So I think something like that in theory is fine. I don't know that you could do, you know, I guess what felt a little bit funny to me about the Facebook movie was that the real facts of Zuckerberg's life departed so much from the story that Sorkin told. And as a journalist, I did have some very, you know, interesting conversations with colleagues about that. Like, that movie depicts him as a really asocial loner, but it turns out that he's been with the same girlfriend, you know, for years and years and years. So that to me is like a little bit of a dicier situation. But I think it's related to your question also about how much of the truth you can really capture. I went into this project knowing that it would have the limitations of any journalistic project, that, you know, whether it's a story we write for the New York Times, you know, this book, or even if I had spent 10 years, you know, working on the book and had even more access than I did, you know, there's no capturing, like, to the extent that there is an omniscient total truth, you know, there's, you know, it's probably impossible to capture in some way. But, you know, the alternatives are not perfect either. Like, if you look at the, you know, what one of the criticisms I got in the last couple of weeks is that, like, essentially, your book is not valid because you're not Michelle Obama and Barack Obama, and only their memoirs are the valid tellings of their stories. And so I couldn't say back to those people, so I will say to you all now, well, let me tell you, memoirs are a rather political genre. If you look at the memoirs that politicians write these days, they are not, you know, once in a while you get a Katherine Graham, right, who wasn't a politician, she was more of a journalist, who writes a truly introspective memoir where she really lays it all on the table. But for politicians, it's almost impossible because memoirs are legacy-shaping exercises, and they have very difficult decisions to make in terms of how they're going to treat people. I mean, say you're the president, right, and you've got some key advisor who basically gave his or her life for you for, you know, 5 or 8 or, you know, or even 10 years, and this advisor really screwed something up that you are really mad about. Well, are you really going to take this person to task in your memoir? Because after all, they worked for you loyally for, you know, 8 or 10 years. Or if you look at, like, Clinton world now, you know, they're endlessly doing these kind of symposia about how great, you know, the presidency was, and these people become a kind of fraternity, right, with the presidential library and the reunions and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I, you know, I think the answer to that is that the coverage of any presidency is a team sport, and that, you know, and that this book is one of many that will be written about the Obama presidency. And, you know, and I look forward to the president and first lady's memoirs, and it really takes the entire body of work to really get at the complexity of it all.
And that,
it takes a village, exactly.
That team sport would certainly be basketball, if your book is to be believed. My favorite little tiny bit was the LeBron James note that he picked, you know, last or whatever within a presidential basketball
game. Right.
Sir, in the back.
I'm just going to repeat briefly. The first question was, are you related to Mickey Cantor? No. And the second question, which will be answered, is where has the First Lady been on economic issues, in particular the hiring of Tim Geithner and Larry Summers and so forth, and would a comparison to Eleanor Roosevelt make any sense?
You know, I do think the Eleanor comparison kind of hovers out there, right, for so many reasons. I mean, I think one of the reasons I think this First Lady is worth taking seriously is that, like Eleanor, she is somebody with a set of ideas about how society works, about opportunity and access and whatnot, that I think are very powerful and very much her own and based on her life experience. And I think it, you know, it'll take time and history and potentially a second administration to see how apt the comparison really is. But I'm glad you mentioned it. You know, on economic policy, I'll give you my sense of where things are. But I want to stipulate that this is a little bit synthetic because there, you know, I don't, it's not like that in my reporting I ever heard about, you know, detailed conversations that Michelle Obama had about the economic team. But I will tell you that one consistent concern of hers was what story the administration was telling to the American people. From very early on in the presidency, she really worried that there wasn't enough clear narration going on, that there wasn't enough kind of clear storytelling about the economic moment we were in and what the administration was doing about it. Now, one reason that didn't happen is because, you know, as we now know from other books, and this is in mine a little bit, the economic team was really divided, you know, early in, for really the first couple of years in the administration. To me, it's really only been since this fall that they've had a kind of clear economic message that, you know, you can summarize pretty concisely. And so I think that that was absolutely one of her concerns.
So if I might just push you one little bit more along those lines, one thing I've heard you talk about in other contexts is that your sense that Michelle Obama has a compelling social and political critique of her own. You answered the question really about communications on some level, which is another thing you talk about in the book, that she's not so much in foreign policy, but she does hit some of the domestic issues, and she's got a lot to say about communications. But maybe just going back to the sort of political, social, what is her social critique that you think is sort of underlying the influence she has in this area?
I think it's shared with the president, and I think it goes back really, really far in their relationship. You know, if you look at the Clinton marriage, it was always very political, right, in nature. They both wanted kind of a political power. And I don't think that that's the essential thing that the Obamas kind of wanted together from the beginning of their relationship. I mean, based on the conversations I've had, I think it's something more like the fact that they were both people who had spent time in very disparate places in society, right? I mean, they were both students here and at other prestigious universities, and yet the president grew up running barefoot in the streets of Jakarta, and the first lady grew up on the South Side. And I think that the two of them together have this kind of shared belief that success is not a product of that, you know, that people in Jakarta or are on the South Street side of Chicago are not like less smart or less good, right, than people who, you know, went to Horace Mann and then get to come to Harvard. I think they believe
this is Boston. You need another
Roxbury Latin or something. And I think they have really powerful shared beliefs about access and opportunity and fairness in society, but also they differ in a really important way, which is that the president has always chosen to carry out his vision of change in a pretty traditional way, especially for a community organizer. He's always been about the legislative process. He's kind of cast his lot with legislative bodies as a way of achieving change in society. And Michelle Obama never believed in that. I mean, she is on the record again and again saying, you know, I just don't think the political process is capable of accomplishing the kind of social change that I want to see. If you look at their time in Chicago when he was commuting down to Springfield, she really disapproved of Springfield because she would hear these stories from him about how good legislation vanished overnight or got loaded with political pork, and it was just so frustrating to her. So I think a really fascinating contrast between the two of them is with the healthcare overhaul and Let's Move. I think it's very significant that she developed Let's Move just when he was having a lot of difficulty passing the healthcare overhaul, because their end goals are not dissimilar, right? I mean, if we eliminated childhood obesity in this country, we would go a long way towards reducing heart disease, diabetes. People would spend less money on healthcare. The system would be less overburdened. We would have healthier Americans. And yet, you know, her kind of methodology with Let's Move is totally different. I mean, there is a legislative component, to be sure, with things like revising nutritional standards for school lunches, but it really has much more to do with going directly to the people, to doctors, building playgrounds, getting people to think about food and exercise differently.
Just to restate briefly, the question was about the Halloween party and how it was reported and in the context of the White House reaction to the book overall.
Well, so the facts in the book about the Halloween party are right. I'm not sure that they were reported the right way on cable TV, and the New York Post sort of took the story and ran with it. The Halloween celebrations that year had two components. There was a public component that was out on the North Portico with the President and First Lady trick-or-treating and Washington area school kids coming for candy, and there were pool reports and photographers, and that was well documented. The part that stayed hush-hush was behind closed doors. And it was a more lavish party, but not the kind of wild bacchanal that has been described in some press reports. The administration was actually trying to do a very nice thing. The party was mostly for kids of military members, but there was, you know, it was, I mean, it was a pretty fabulous party. They got Johnny Depp and Tim Burton, who were releasing their Alice in Wonderland movie, to come. Tim Burton decorated, and Johnny Depp came in costume, and they put on like a pretty spectacular show for these kids. And what happened is that there was a lot of nervousness in the administration, especially on the kind of Robert Gibbs side, of any entertaining that looked too lavish or too Hollywood in light of what was going on economically. So the party inside was the part that was not documented. You know, there was no pool reporter there. Burton's contribution, Depp's contribution were never acknowledged, et cetera, et cetera. So the other thing that I think is really lost in that story is that when I tell the story in the book, it's actually part of Michelle Obama's sort of change in her approach to first ladyhood, because at that point, she's starting to leave some of the entertaining stuff behind, and she is she's starting to formulate Let's Move, and she's a couple of months away from making her plans on military families. So the, you know, if you read it in the context of the book, the greater meaning of it is really that, you know, she's beginning to see that this is not what her first ladyhood is about, and that she wants more meaningful projects of her own.
Yes, please. It's a hard question, though, to be clear, but thinking about your own legacy shaping and your own relationship with the White House, and knowing that you will continue to be a political correspondent, how you think about that and how it has, in fact, if at all, affected how you framed any scenes?
So the short answer is that I did not make any calculated decisions to keep certain things out of the book or to write about certain people in a more flattering way to preserve access. For a couple of reasons. One is that as a journalist, I feel I have responsibilities to so many groups of people. I have responsibilities to everybody I write about. I have responsibilities to my sources. But I really feel that my most profound responsibility is to all of you, is to people who are going to read the book. And so to sort of, you know, not be honest with you, I think, is a big problem. It's part of the reason why we have a rule at the New York Times. New York Times reporters do not talk to presidents and first ladies off the record. Because we don't want, if we have time with a president or first lady, we think it's unethical, basically, to kind of hoard that, right? To do more than a minute or two of private chit-chat, or you don't want to be the kind of journalist who, like, tells a great off-the-record story about the president or first lady at a dinner party but doesn't actually share it with readers. And I also felt that I had to write an honest book. I mean, I hope, you know, I tried to do the same in my New York Times articles. I had to write what I was really seeing, even though some of the things you'll see in the book are painful and difficult. And then the last part of it is that I'm not sure that trick really works. that even if you were to withhold stuff or try to flatter people in print, that it would really work for two reasons. One of which is that there's so little access to begin with, right? I mean, presidents and first ladies almost never give searching, long, honest interviews about what they're experiencing. I am so lucky to have had that experience with the Obamas, you know, in 2009, to have had it at all. I mean, when I work on the Long Run series at the New York Times, which is our biographical series on presidential candidates. We almost never get to interview them. The White House correspondents at the New York Times, the reporters who cover him day to day, they've sat down with the president once since inauguration. Once, and if we don't get to do it, who gets to do it, right? So, and also with sources, I do think that if you kind of pull your punches and are not honest in print, you can have the opposite problem, right, of people respecting you less. I mean, I really did try to treat, everybody fairly and with dignity, and that's just sort of always the way I've tried to operate. But it's a great question. You know, the story of what happened to Obama's BlackBerry is to me one of the great metaphors of this administration, right? Because you guys know the story. Here is somebody who revolutionized online campaigning in 2008, who created a kind of web-based relationship with supporters that nobody had ever had before, and also had a BlackBerry and kept in touch with hundreds, if not thousands, of people during the campaign, which was a fabulous way of getting all sorts of feedback. And as you say, not everybody he kept in touch with was like politically correct, right? There were, all sorts of interesting, assorted and sundry figures who he talked to. So he gets to the White House. Because of legal and security reasons, he can't have a BlackBerry. He's given this kind of hack-proof military facsimile. It's what, like, generals carry in Afghanistan. And he's only allowed to email with 10 or 15 people. And so, I think it really goes to the paradox of the presidency, which is the combination of power and powerlessness. I mean, how is it that the guy has the nation's nuclear codes, and yet we don't let him have the same BlackBerry that we would let a 17-year-old have?
There are good reasons for that, Jody.
but then, just to answer the question more fully, is that I think that, and by the way, that's part of why I wrote, I want to borrow your book in a sec, that's part of why I wrote in such detail about the isolation of the modern presidency, which is worse even than it was. It's really a post-September 11th change. The Obamas are so much more restricted than even most of their predecessors have been. And, the book includes these maps and floor plans of the White House because I really wanted to show the intense confinement, not as a, kind of lifestyle issue, but because I think it's connected to the substantive question of how did this guy who had such an electric connection with so many Americans in 2008 lose so much of that connection? The last thing I'll say is that he is different in private. You'll see a chapter in the book about Obama when he's alone with his friends. And they're the Obama who is looser and funnier and more sarcastic and willing to say what he thinks is still there. He just shares that person with an extremely small group of friends.
Question is, where do the Obamas get their news? And were they frustrated by the news cycle?
Yeah, super frustrated. You'll see example after example of it in the book. In terms of where they get their news, what I know is that the First Lady often reads the press clippings that are distributed throughout the White House. The president is a total news junkie. Like, his deputy press secretary was Bill Burton, and Obama would sit there clicking on his BlackBerry, looking at the headlines on NewYorkTimes.com, and he would say to Bill, "What's in the news, Burton?" And Bill would be like, "You're looking at the New York Times," but he always wanted to know more. He wanted to know the next thing. Obama is very harsh in his critique of, cable TV and a lot of the sort of quick hit stories. He does prefer to read The Economist and The New Yorker. And there have been times, there's a story that takes place in the summer of 2010 you know, he makes comments about the Islamic Center that may be built near Ground Zero. And what he says is that Muslims have the same constitutional right to build a house of worship as anybody else in the country. It gets interpreted and played as POTUS says build the mosque. And he was incredibly frustrated by that and, you know, and wanted to keep going back to reporters to keep clarifying his statements. And I think, you know, I think has had a really, it's always been a struggle for him. I mean, we, you know, even in early debates, he had a lot of trouble getting his thoughts down to kind of soundbite length.
So maybe I could turn to the previous question for your last question and comment.
I guess, you know, I guess the thing that I, you know, wish people ask me and that I hope people ask me in the future is that they really read the book, because the, you know what I think one problem with the writing a book in this kind of news cycle is, and the reaction to this book is that the whole point of a book also is to, a book like this is to watch people change. I mean, to me, one of the revelations of the reporting was that I really felt I could document the effect of power on the Obamas, the effect of this environment, the way they were changing. And there were a lot of people who kind of read the first chapter or two, and I think maybe didn't...
It's a good introduction.
Thank you, but didn't necessarily realize that the Obamas you meet in the first few pages are very different from the Obamas you read, you know, on page 300. So I'd say, you know, as an author, what I'm most looking forward to is, I mean, these first few weeks are very exciting and heady, but what I... My biggest wish is that, you know, I hope you guys will read the book and that I continue to meet people even years later who say, oh, you know, that thing really captured my attention or reminded me of something. And, you know, one thing that's been really a pleasure is being on Twitter, too, during this process and being able to mix it up with readers who do have reactions.
So that was where I was going to end, actually, which was sort of a thank you to everyone for coming, but also to encourage you, you can read Jodi Kantor in almost any length, from the book length to the New York Times Magazine to the New York Times cover page story, down to 140 characters at Jodi Kantor, and I encourage you to do so. To the Harvard Bookstore, Jeff in particular, thank you so much, and to Alex for hosting this event. And please join me in thanking Jodi Kantor.